This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th, and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
I'm Elvis Mitchell. Welcome to The Treatment. If you thought there's nobody left to kill in the South after House of a Thousand Corpses, you are wrong. It's writer-director Rob Zombie is here. His new movie, of course, is The Devil's Rejects. Rob, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First of all, did you know you want to do a sequel?
Actually, I didn't want to do a sequel. I wrote a little treatment that said, you know, Brother of Sheriff avenges his death and packed it away. Because I knew if the movie, the first one, did well enough, they would make a sequel. With or without me was basically what the contract said. And I was hoping more for with me if it had to be done. But I hate sequels. Sequels are always, for the most part, terrible. But sequels can be good. I mean, I think Road Warrior is better than Mad Max, you know, so it can happen. You just have to do something different. And I didn't want to try to recreate the first movie, so.
Well, you don't, because this one actually feels a lot closer to like Last House on the Left or some of the Wes Craven things, whereas the first one reminded me a little bit more of maybe, say, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, the first one I always felt was sort of like Rocky Horror Picture Show, but bloody. The feeling, because it's kind of wackier. And this one I wanted to make feel like Western almost, a lot of the violence.
But that's sort of that sense of dread of some of the great Wes Craven movies.
Yeah, I mean, when you want, yeah, like, especially Hills Have Eyes in Last House. I mean, the scene out, you know, David Hess out in the woods with the girls in Last House on the Left is just so depraved. But I say that in a good way because it's so shocking. I mean, I just got off the phone doing an interview and someone's first question was like, why would you make a movie like this? And that always seems like such a stupid, like, do you want everything to be kitty cats and puppy dogs? Would that make your life better? You know? Because, I don't know, because it's fun.
Let me ask you a question because this is something I was thinking about as I was watching it the other day. Do you think these movies actually play better in sort of like exploitation houses or drive-ins and they do seem like a legitimate first run kind of thing? You know what I mean? Because it's kind of weight that you give a movie – it's seen in a different venue?
I definitely think so. Every time I saw like anything, the first time Dawn of the Dead or any movie like that, I always saw it in a really sleazy drive. Not because I wanted to, but that was always where they were playing. Some sleazy drive-in, some second-run theater, 42nd Street for sure. And there is something that adds to it because it does sort of feel like where does the movie end and the theater begin? Because what's going on in the seat behind you is disgusting as what's on screen. But when you do go to the super nice Cineplex with the $9 popcorn, it does take away from it a little bit. But I think that's what's going to be shocking to people. I think that there's a whole generation of people that have never seen a movie like this in a theater. They've seen them on DVD.
Right.
But, I mean, it's been a while since you've seen this type of thing, I think.
I just wonder, too, if that's why you think people are reacting to it the way they do these movies. Because these movies didn't used to really get written about. I mean, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of like floated around for a couple of years before anybody wrote about it.
Right. These people sort of rewrite history about how they think about things. Like, you know, they'll celebrate these films at the Museum of Modern Art now, but they certainly weren't, well, upon their release. And that's what I said to the guy who was kind of arguing with me about the thing. I was like, look, if this was 1976, we wouldn't even be having this discussion because movies were more intense. I mean, even, you know, The Godfather violence or Taxi Driver, I mean, violence was just more real. But I think the 80s violence became so cartoony with Stallone and Schwarzenegger and Van Damme that people forgot that when they see something that's even remotely real, they get kind of weirded out.
It's the truth. My guess is filmmaker Rob Zombie, we're talking about his films, but his newest film is The Devil's Rejects. Rob, if you could, tell us what the movie's about.
Well, the movie is basically the story of three escaped killers on the run from a very obsessed sheriff who will do anything in a very vigilante Western style way to bring them to justice. And it's not essentially a horror movie, although it's incredibly horrific. It's more like a 70s style Sam Peckinpah shoot 'em up.
It's a title that actually sounds like it could be from that era too.
Yeah, I thought it had that sort of the Dirty Dozen feel. Like just something where you're like, what? Because it could, you know, it could be anything. When you assume because, you know, maybe because it's me, it's a certain type of movie. But if it was, you go, it's a war movie. And you'd think it was like, you know, like it's got that sort of like it could be anything.
And it's also cast pretty wonderfully too. I mean, just seeing
with a lot of great people.
Oh my God, just having Sid Haig and Michael Berryman in a movie like this, guys who obviously you grew up seeing in movies anyway.
It was kind of fun putting everyone in one movie because they've all been in great movies. singularly, you know, like Ken from Dawn of the Dead, Michael Hills Have Eyes, and Sid from, I don't know, Black Mama, White Mama, you name it, everything. And PJ Souls from Rock and Roll High School. But this,
and Deborah Van Valkenburg from The Warriors.
Warriors, and E.G. Daly from Pee Wee's Big Adventure, or Steve Railsback from Helter Skelter.
And William Forsythe.
William Forsythe from everything. Raising Arizona or whatever. But it's just fun sticking them all in one movie together.
What was the thing you felt was toughest to you to do, for you to do as a director? I mean, because the movie does shift in tone a lot.
I mean, the hardest thing was to – I mean, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted the tone of this film to be a lot darker and a lot more real than the first movie. And that was – but trying to get the returning actors to do that was difficult because they've already established their characters. And I essentially, you know, had to take – you know, talk to someone like Sid and go, look, Sid, I know this is Captain Spaulding. This is what you've created. This is what – you know, now there's action figures and you have fans and this is what they love. But I don't want you to do that anymore. You know, I don't want you to wear funny T-shirts or say funny phrases or be this guy. I want to make it a real person. And the same thing with Bill Moseley, who, you know, I'd have, a lot of times during filming, I'd say, okay, you know, let's take it down. You're just slipping back into this sort of cartoon-ish way of playing it. And I don't want to play it that way.
And did you feel like, because it does become quite melodramatic. There's a scene that Forsythe has with the mother that's really kind of quite spooky.
Yeah, William was great to have in the movie because William was coming from a, you know, he had his way he wanted to play it. We discussed it early on how, you know, if Lee Marvin was still alive, we would have wanted to cast Lee Marvin, you know. And that's how William sort of looked at it. And he sort of dictated a good tone because he never, ever is on the verge of ever wanting to be campy. He's very serious when he's acting, when he's just hanging out with you. He's a very serious guy. So he helped set like a real like, ominous tone that kept like a barometer on a lot of other people's performances in a way.
But it's funny too because you still got all these sort of the in-jokes or a lot of the in-jokes in the first one, like all the Groucho Marx references.
Yeah. There's a lot of wacky stuff in there if you get it, but it doesn't – it's not – I don't think it's that overt.
Yeah, it is.
Well, for some people it's – well, I mean it sort of all explodes when the film critic comes in and goes on a tirade.
Yeah, I feel better about myself too.
that's not an anti-film critic thing.
It's the truth. My guess is Rob Zombie. We're talking about The Devil's Rejects. One of the things that seems to me kind of a part of this, and I don't know how familiar you are with this stuff, is the old EC horror comics.
Oh, I love EC, yeah.
And a lot of the sort of the violence in this, specifically in this, more so even the first one, reminds me of that kind of stuff where there's violence but a moral consequence to it.
Yeah, I never wanted the violence to be fun, you know. I mean – and it's funny watching the movie with an audience that doesn't know. Like, because people a lot of times think like violence in horror movies or these types of movies, I don't know if it's really a horror movie, is fun. Like if, you know, if Jason cuts someone's head off with a machete, the audience kind of cheers because it's kind of funny. And when I'm watching the movie with an audience, they sort of start reacting in that way at first. And then by the time we get to – there's a motel room scene where the character of Otis sort of terrorizes this woman played by Priscilla Barnes, you can feel the fun factor get sucked out of the room and the audience has that like, oh, now I just feel bad. There's nothing funny going on here. Because, yeah, no, I wanted the violence to be horrible. It's not supposed to be funny.
Well, those Wes Craven movies we're talking about, and again, these EC comics too, which also Wes has talked about.
I don't think
about,
anyone's laughing during Last House on the Left.
No, you're not supposed to be. I mean, and there's also that kind of sense of, and that's why I was talking about the venue, because there's that sort of sense of claustrophobia that these movies have that's really kind of exacerbated by seeing them in a really creepy place.
I think so. I mean, I remember as a kid, and this is kind of a weird example, but the first time I saw Psycho, my parents were redoing their house, and they had ripped all the walls down in the living room. So it was just this bare, old, exposed wood, and they ripped out everything. But they left the couch and the TV because they knew I'd go berserk if I couldn't watch TV for like one day. And I was watching Psycho for the first time in this room that was basically just rotted wood. And your mind does start playing tricks on you. And after a while, I felt like I was in the Bates Motel because the situation I was watching it in was so reflective of what I was seeing in the movie that you really – yeah, and I think that's true. You really start – I'm sure if you watched The Shining in a big hotel all by yourself, you'd feel more freaked out.
or go to sleep faster, one or the other. But I think that there's that kind of sense of sort of anarchy that certainly you can find in your music, but also kind of translates to this too, where the sense of order is so sort of dissipated that you don't know where to turn to.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what makes people uncomfortable, because I think there's nothing – and this is what's so great about the 70s horror movies we're talking about, or just 70s movies in general, not even just horror movies. There's no safety net. You never felt like the filmmakers – even like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, when Harvey Keitel breaks through the door, you're like, oh my God, what's going on? You know, there's – you don't know where these films are ever going, whereas now you always feel like it's going to be okay. The star of the film will be okay. It's going to have a happy ending, because no one can ever leave a movie on a downer. Even if the entire world's being destroyed, we somehow have to be happy at the end. And in the 70s, you didn't feel that way. It was like, you know, everyone, I'm sure, walked out of Taxi Driver like, what did we just watch?
See, because I'm wondering too, because Wes Craven has been here before and yeah. talked about the politics of those movies, about how he was using these movies to sort of deal with Vietnam right. and sort of sense of social unrest in the same way the Taxi Driver dealt with
sure.
it. And that must be some part of this for you too, isn't it?
I think there's like a generational thing. They're the product of Vietnam, I think. You know, like you just said. And I'm the product of their product in a way. You know, I think I was more shaped by what – they were shaped by world events. They made these pieces of art, and then the pieces of art they made shaped me more than the world events.
But there's certainly enough stuff going on now that you
– Oh, yeah.
These movies – and I
think so.
I feel both these movies are responding to that in some way. Do you think maybe even subconsciously?
Probably. I mean, because one thing I did notice that this is a little off topic what you're saying, but House of a Thousand Corpses had some problems getting released until after 9/11. Nobody cared. In good times, everybody's like, oh, let's blame everything on video games or movies or something. And then when a world event happens that's that tragic – and clearly nobody in the Taliban was playing Grand Theft Auto and decided to, you know, attack the World Trade Center. Everyone's priorities go back to normal. And they realize that, you know, movies don't make people do terrible things.
This is a treatment we're talking to Rob Zombie. His new film is The Devil's Rejects. But what you're doing is, again, you're making a movie that's not jokey about this kind of stuff. That's not saying that, you know, hey, somebody's going to come and pull you out of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't, you know, it was funny. I never wanted to be jokey. I mean, there's funny elements, like there's funny scenes.
That's what I'm saying with this one specifically. Yeah. I mean, you actually, I think, balanced the comedy and the melodrama a lot more smoothly than you did the first
one. Yeah, the first one was just my first movie, you know, you just don't know how to, you know, until you're done and you've cut it together and you look at it, that's the only time you know, like, okay, here's what worked and here's what clearly didn't work. And, you know, I'll keep that in mind next time. I mean, how else? You know, there's only one way to like learn how to make good movies, and that's to make them. And this time it was like I thought about not having any like humorous bits at all. But then I thought, oh my God, this movie would become so oppressive to watch after a while. It would probably be unwatchable. After an hour, you'd be like, I have to leave. I can't take this.
Are you sort of thinking, too, that the reaction, because we were talking about the reactions to that those movies we're talking about didn't get any kind of real sort of approval from the critical society until years and years later. Do you think that may be the case with these films, too?
I think it's really weird because, yeah, all the movies that we love, we didn't care. We weren't waiting for people to tell us that to go see those because we liked them. I mean, I think of those type of movies the same way I would think of going to CBGB's to watch a punk rock band. I wasn't waiting for Rolling Stone to tell me the Ramones were good. Who cares? It was good because Rolling Stone didn't like them because you thought of them as a bunch of old hippies and they were still talking about Jerry Garcia. And that's what these movies were. I didn't want to see Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo. You know what I mean? I wanted to see Dawn of the Dead or, you know what I mean, whatever else was coming out at that time.
We'll take a break and diss more Disney movies with Rob Zombie after this. His new film is The Devil's Rejects. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is Rob Zombie, filmmaker Rob Zombie. His new film is The Devil's Rejects. But I'm glad you brought that up about you because there is an expectation that people have
right.
just because, I mean, you've been as demonized as video games and Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo and any other horrible thing we can think of. And you must – a big part of you has to enjoy sort of playing on people's expectations of what to get from you.
Well, it's really funny too because a lot of times I don't think about it. You know, this has just been the stuff that I've always loved. and I've always loved extreme things, that it's not till you encounter and all my friends do and everyone that I hang out with does, and it's not till you encounter people that don't that you go, oh my God, I didn't really think it would be that offensive to somebody. Because I've never set out to be offensive or to be shocking, because I always say that's easy. You know, you could do something disgusting, you know, and horrible and shock somebody. I was, you know, I always try to set out to be artful and entertaining and do things that are good. But, you know, I mean, I don't just want to make movies like this. I mean, the next movie will probably be something very, very different.
Well, but we were talking about this a little bit earlier. There is a certain kind of anarchy that you seem to be attracted to. And finding a way to sort of dramatize that either through song or through the stage presentations,
yeah,
or in this movie, these movies too.
I like things that are real, that don't feel like they're made just to make money, and they don't feel like they're part of some kind of just corporate system. Even though you could say, well, this is, but it wasn't made like that. I mean, this is not – nobody could watch this movie and go, oh, yeah, this is clearly – everything in this movie was done just for this reason. Because the people I cast are clearly not the type of people that you would cast – if you're trying, you know, they're great actors and they're awesome, but, you know, they're older actors, they're character actors. That's not the way you would go if you, you know, you're not going to attract the MTV TRL crowd with with these people. But I think maybe you will. I mean, I think maybe that's a fallacy. I just think that.
But your name is going to attract that crowd to some extent.
Well, yeah, probably. But, you know, that's, you know, that for good or for bad, that's just is what it is. But I just like things that seem like they're just, you know, whether it's Napoleon Dynamite or Reservoir Dogs. You know, just when you can sense something's just true to itself.
So you also
it's not a fake creation.
Yeah, something that really comes out of somebody's sensibility, yeah, as compared to this thing you're just trying,
right,
to put together to pull in a certain demographic.
Totally. I mean, and that's the stuff that I love.
But obviously, you've got to get some small amount of pleasure in shocking people too.
Oh, yeah. No, it's always funny because someone said something to me yesterday that I was like, this is – I was at MTV or something, and someone there said, I saw your movie last night. It was great. You know, I threw up in my mouth a little bit at one scene. That's like a horrible, I'm like, God, that's more disgusting than anything in the movie, but it just was so funny.
Well, it certainly has a pungency that defies conventional film criticism, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, you can't top that.
I'm not going to try to. It's the treatment. My guess is Rob Zombie. I'm not going to top anything here. We're talking about The Devil's Rejects. As I'm watching a movie, though, it really feels to me like it feels like more like three parts, three acts than the first one did. And I,
yeah,
wonder if that was a conscious thing for you this time out, too.
On every level, I mean, I just, you know, like I said, the first film, I mean, some people, their first film might be their best film they ever make, and it's all downhill. I mean, we've seen that happen before. But for me, it was like the first film was just, that was the training ground. That was boot camp. You know, that was learning how to do things and
how to
make
it work.
You were
really treating it like that, as if it were.
Well, I wasn't treating it like that, but that's sort of what it turned out to be, because you can think you know how films are made or what you're going to do, but it's the stuff that no one ever talks about that's chaotic on set.
Like what?
Well, I mean, you just don't think that this day one of shooting, you walk on set and the first words out of your first AD's mouth will be like, we're behind schedule, practically. You know, I mean, you're always behind schedule and you got to get this by lunch. You got to get this before everything. Like, you're totally. It's like beat the clock at all times with people breathing down your neck. And that's just a bizarre way to create something that's supposed to be art, because it's not, you know, but you have to do the person who gave me the best piece of advice unknowingly was many years ago. I was on the set of Escape from L.A. talking to John Carpenter. And I don't even know how this came up at all, but he said, making movies is not about art. It's trying to get that army over that mountain before the sun comes up. And that's really what it turns into. That's why when you see films that are great, you're like, how does this ever happen? It's a miracle that movies even get made. It's such an insane process.
And when you see House of a Thousand Corpses now, do you sort of see kind of the heartache it took to just get up there on the screen more,
yeah,
than you see the movie?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, there's things about it I really like, and there's things about it I really don't like, but it's – you just have to accept it for what it is. I mean, you know, your first anything, I'm sure, is just you're in the dark trying to figure out how to do things. And I didn't really have a good support system at the time. You know, because a movie is a group effort. So, you know, you need great people around you. And on a lot of levels, I didn't have it in that film. But, you know, as you acquire, you know, great people to be around you, it makes things much, you know, it's a better way to work.
As you were talking about this, I wonder, how many film sets had you visited before? Had you been on many sets?
No, not very often. I mean, a couple. I think the first time I ever got to be on a film set was when they were shooting The Crow. down in Carolco Studios, and then a couple other times.
That was something really going wrong there.
Yeah, that was weird. I mean, I got to hang out with Brandon Lee one night. That was like about 2 weeks before he died. And it was, you know, that was the first time I ever got to be on a film set.
And what was that like for you?
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I was always, of course, insane about movies, but never had the opportunity to be on a film set for any reason. And, you know, other times over the years, because then I would have music on soundtracks, so I'd get to, you know, sometimes visit if it was possible, like Escape from L.A. I was really excited to go down, and because I was a big fan of Escape from New York and John Carpenter, so that was exciting. But, you know, really not much experience. And whenever you go to a film set, it feels like nothing's happening. You know, anyone here working? I don't see anyone doing anything. You know, it's just a weird atmosphere.
And because you can't step inside that pressure until you're actually a part of that mechanism.
Right. And I mean, and it is different. I mean, if you have, you know, we had 29 days to shoot the movie, which is insane. And people keep saying, how did Clint Eastwood possibly shoot Million Dollar Baby in 50 days or 40 days? I'm like, it takes place in one room practically. You know, I would shoot this thing in 29 days. I mean, we had like the opening gunfight. We had one day to shoot, and it's psychotic. So our film set did seem busy. People were running. You know, if someone went to the bathroom, the whole set would be like, where the hell is he? You know?
Well, what was the schedule for House of a Thousand Corpses?
That was about 2 weeks longer.
Why was this a shorter shoot?
Because it was half the budget.
This was less than your first
movie. Yeah, half.
Congratulations. You're kind of going backwards here a little bit, Rob.
Well, it was like, you know, Universal Studios obviously has a lot more money than Lionsgate. So, you know, for Lionsgate, this was a big investment. But the thing that didn't really matter was what I learned. I know how to break down the budget now. So I could get more out of $7 million than I could out of $14 million. Because of the first, you don't know. There's just waste all day long. And now I knew where the waste was, so it didn't happen. It all went on screen. But it's been like that with everything. I mean, the most expensive record I ever made was the first one.
Really?
Because you get in there and you go like – and after a while you go like, okay, I don't need you. You don't do anything. You can go home. You do nothing. No, you're not ordering lobster. You're not, you know, and you go in like, this is how we're making the movie. And if you don't like it, you know, hit the road. Because there's so much waste and waste. It just goes on.
So you're basically saying you got to do it to learn how to do it.
Yeah, because you just – and you don't know. And I think that – restrictions make you creative because you have to solve problems with your brain, and you don't just throw money at it. You know, because I mean, you see movies now. I mean, the simplest comedy costs $40 million, and then every big movie is over $100 million. But are these the best movies that have ever been made? The movies just keep getting better and better. No, they just keep getting more expensive because oh my god, we don't know how to end it. Just blow something up. Flip a car.
The thing we're talking about here, too, and you're almost giving away the end of your movie, but the thing we're talking about here is that reflection of a sensibility, that filmmaker or an artist or whomever is saying, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
This is where it comes from in me. This is the questions I'm trying to answer in myself.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's really all it's about. I mean, and the thing is, the way to make it work with what we were just saying was, you know, I knew how much money I had, so I would work backwards from that. I didn't try to make a $50 million movie with $7 million. I made a $7 million movie with $7 million. So you never look at it and go like, oh, boy, looks like they need more money.
No, you don't.
No, everybody looks at it and goes like, why did you have $25 million?
This is a treatment we're talking to Rob Zombie. His new film is The Devil's Rejects. I guess, though, what I'm really struck by in seeing Otis is how much he looks like Charles Manson.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, the original inspiration for the Otis character was he looks like Johnny Winter, but he thinks like Charles Manson. And that's how he sort of looked in the first movie. And in this movie, I thought that the original look for him, which we tested out, didn't fly. It just, you know, within the context of the first movie, that had a surreal enough feeling because a lot of the lighting with this sort of like Bava-style lighting was like, you know, if it's a tree, you light it green, you know, like where the things are a little over the top. But this, with it being really gritty and the sunlight in the desert, I just had to play him more real.
Because that's what I'm saying. I mean, it actually gives it more of a kind of horrific context.
Yeah.
He looks more like an actual sort of figure you'd see who did this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, he looks like Charles Manson or a Hell's Angels from back then or Greg Allman, you know? You know, any like guy from back then I remember as a kid, you know?
But also, too, I mean, to playing into that, this wall-to-wall 70s music, which is always the one thing that was missing from all those movies we're talking about, always had really sort of crappy soundtracks.
Because they couldn't afford good music.
Or any music. But,
yeah.
but this time around, you use that music to give a real sense of place and period this time out, weren't you?
Yeah, I thought that was very important because my 70s experience looks more like this movie. It doesn't, you know, because a lot of times now, every time somebody goes to the 70s, to make a period movie, they turn it into Boogie Nights. But that wasn't everybody's 70s. You know, you look back at the 70s, that's more normal, and it's like everybody sort of looks like leftover guys from Woodstock who didn't quite get it, you know, never discovered disco. I didn't know about disco as a kid. That didn't hit my town, you know. I didn't go to Studio 54, and everybody still looked like they were in Led Zeppelin. But music was always super important. I mean, I was obsessed with radio as a kid, so I never remember music not being around. So that's why I wanted to figure in importantly in the movie.
But also that sort of that southern guitar sound.
Yeah.
Which is very much the kind of thing that you always thought in your head would be scoring these movies anyway,
yeah.
Didn't you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, when I was writing the movie, I was listening to those songs, the ones that ended up in the movie, and there was just something about, you know, Skinner and the Allman Brothers that there's just a weird vibe to those songs. They're very unconventional for music now that those would be very popular songs because, you know, some songs are 15 minutes long. I mean, they're long, these big epics, but they're also like – they're kind of depressing songs. They're kind of rocking, but they're very depressing at the same time. They have very soulful voices, those guys, and – that's sort of how the movie felt. Like, especially the opening credit sequence with the Allman Brothers song. It's like, I wanted to feel like the movie's kicking in and we're kind of getting ready to go on this journey. But I wanted it to be kind of depressing because of what we were watching. So it kind of fed both things.
And the clips we see, the video clips or the TV clips we see too, are just the kind of thing where if you were flicking around your television in the 70s,
yeah,
those are the kind of things you discover.
Yeah, that was what was on TV. I mean, if you're flicking your 12 channels that you had on your TV and probably four of them didn't come in good, you know, that's what you'd see, like the Buck Owens Ranch show or Hee Haw or some crappy local show. That's what I remember. There's never anything good on TV.
But you must have wanted, too, for this movie to have this sort of sense of – for you're talking about One Room for Another movie, but this sense of being either outside in all this space and nowhere to run.
Right.
Or being trapped inside of a room.
Yeah, I always wanted it to be two things. Like, that's why it's mostly set in daylight, you know, because I thought there's nothing scarier. And this all relates back to an incident that happened to me as a kid.
What's that?
Well, this is very strange. This is something that seems like something out of like a David Lynch movie. But one summer, you know, we lived in a pretty normal neighborhood, just like some boring suburban neighborhood. We were like in the backyard playing and we heard this guy screaming. We're like, what's that noise? It sounded like a dog or something. We couldn't tell, you know, when someone screams. And we look out in the front yard and there's this naked guy, kind of like chubby naked guy, running down the street who had just been stabbed in this like normal like Brady Bunch neighborhood with like sprinklers going off and it's summertime. And it was so bizarre. And that always stuck with me. And that's why I thought like taking them out into these big, wide open, bright places and seeing horrific events always seems so much freakier than, you know, making it dark and spooky. And so I thought, yeah, that, and then juxtaposing wide open places where there's nowhere to go because, good, run for miles in the desert. It doesn't matter. You're not going to get anywhere. And then just jamming, like, all these people into a tiny little motel room. Either way, it's uncomfortable.
Well, we're out of time, so I hope you weren't too uncomfortable although you're sitting
very uncomfortable, just like this room.
Thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
My guest is Ram Zabi. His new movie is The Devil's Rejects, the sequel and continuation of, and many other things, to House of a Thousand Corpses. Our technical director in Los Angeles is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Lasha Wojcik at Carnegie Recording Studios. Bob Carlson is the editor, and we hope to produce this program. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Ooh, it's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.